Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 164 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the most exciting and promising young actors in the business, a 25-year-old British actor of Nigerian descent who shot to international stardom in 2015 as one of the three principal stars of J.J. Abrams' Star Wars The Force Awakens, which received rave reviews and became the third highest-grossing film of all time, and who now is starring in one of the best-reviewed films of 2017 so far, Kathryn Bigelow's Detroit. I'm talking, of course, about John Boyega. Boyega first crossed the radar of some in Hollywood, including Abrams, with his big-screen debut in the 2011 British indie Attack the Block, a sci-fi horror comedy in which he starred as a resident of a South London housing project descended upon by alien monsters. Over the ensuing few years, he made a TV pilot for Spike Lee, appeared opposite Kiefer Sutherland in Fox's 24 Live Another Day miniseries, and anchored the film that won the Audience Award at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival, Imperial Dreams. But his profile exploded in April 2014, when word got out that Abrams had tapped him for the first installment of Star Wars in a decade. 20 months later, when the movie opened, people around the world were introduced to Boyega as Finn, a disillusioned stormtrooper who joins the Resistance. Boyega will appear in his next Star Wars film, the Rian Johnson-directed The Last Jedi, this coming December. But in the meantime, he can be seen in Detroit, a film based on a true story, which began rolling out in select theaters on August 4th and soon will expand to many more, and which Boyega has called, quote, the biggest movie of my career so far, close quote, and, quote, far beyond anything I've ever done, close quote. In it, he plays Melvin Dismukes, a security guard who, during the 1967 Detroit riot, winds up in the Motor City's Algiers Motel as a horrific instance of police brutality unfolds before his eyes. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, Boyega and I discussed a wide range of topics, among them how he became enamored with acting at a young age and how he wound up landing his first film role over 1,500 other London teens, why he grew a bit disillusioned after repeatedly being asked to star in what he calls, quote, urban movies, close quote, early in his career, what the long process that led to him being in Star Wars entailed, and what he has learned and experienced, good, bad, and ugly, since his casting was announced, why he feels so passionately about Detroit, and what he makes of the race-related questions that have been raised by and about the film, what details he can tease about The Last Jedi, and how he learned about and has handled the death of his close collaborator in that film, Carrie Fisher, plus much more. So, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. John, thank you so much for doing this.
How you doing?
We always just begin with a basic. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I'm born and raised in London. My dad's a minister, and my mum worked in a place for disabled people.
Sure.
Caretaker for them.
I was reading interviews with you and profiles going back to the very beginning, and it seems like as far as the very beginning for you of acting, it goes back to, what were you, a leopard? That was what it sounded like in one of these interviews.
Or some school stuff that, yeah, I was doing back in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just doing it for fun.
Yeah, but you, yeah, did you know very early on that this was something you were particularly into, or was it just one of a lot of things?
No, it's just this was just my thing from early on. So I decided to just pursue it. It was a hobby at first.
Who is Teresa Early?
That's my theater director from the first theater school I attended.
And at how young was that?
I started when I was 9 or 10, I think, and I was there for a few years. But yeah, she was basically the one that got me into acting, like, professionally.
Because she had seen you at a school, just a regular kind of school play, and saw,
yeah,
something.
It was my teacher told another teacher at her school.
Yeah.
And then she came down and she saw me in something.
Did she ever tell you what it was about you that impressed her?
Nah, and I didn't ask because she said I can get into a theater school for free. So I was just like, all
right,
cool.
I'm there, right? She has said that your father took some convincing that acting was a noble profession.
No, she was talking nonsense.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, she was talking smack then.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So he was always on board.
Yeah, yeah. My dad was cool with it. It wasn't him saying that he didn't want me to do it. It was more like, okay, we don't know what this career is.
Right.
I didn't know what acting was, and neither did anybody. So he just needed some some explaining about it.
Here's another thing she said, and I just wonder if you can, maybe this is also not right, but she says, quote, "I think it's quite conceivable, frankly, that his father as a role model did give John a good idea of how to hold an audience. Do you think there's anything about your father's work as a preacher that maybe correlates with what you do?"
Yeah, I think so. But I've never, back then I didn't think about it as like a thing. I didn't watch my dad and go, you know, I want to be an actor. I guess it just runs in the family. He's a very well-spoken, charismatic man, so he just got something about him.
Yeah. It sounds like one youth theater group sort of leads to another and leads to just various things. I mean, performing at Royal Albert Hall at 13, that's not every kid. Acting at some of these productions were at the National Theater. But it sounds like it was in 2009 when you got a small role in a big ensemble that was at the Tricycle Theater in North London.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really a pivotal one because you were again seen by somebody who took an interest in you, right?
No, I got Tricycle off. That was my first job as an actor at the Tricycle.
The first theater. Professional job.
Yeah, my first.
But wasn't it through that Joe Cornish first learned about you?
I don't know if he came to the play. I don't know.
Yeah.
I found out about Attack the Block for an open audition online.
You had just read it, that there was
I read about it.
Production in London.
Between that open audition and actually going for a professional audition, I got an agent. So then I was able to go in, like, you know, the much more
intimate way. How did the agent happen? How did that come about?
I went to another drama school called Identity Drama School.
Mm-hmm.
And the founder, Femi Oggins, became my agent after he saw me, you know, obviously in the pieces that they had at the school. And then I got Tri-School.
Gotcha. That was 2009. By 2011, you were in Attack the Block, and we should say, for anyone who hasn't yet seen it, this, you're playing Moses, who's a resident of a South London housing project that ends up targeted by aliens or, you know, people from things from out of this world.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Joe Cornish, the director, had looked at 1,500 teens over several months, but before concluding that you were the right guy for this.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said he, quote, "cast the rest of the gang and attacked the block around him, around you, because he was so good and had such quiet charisma," close quote. So that's got to be quite something when you're still a teen. And I guess was it your first big screen thing?
Yeah, definitely.
To be leading a movie. Yeah. How did you acclimate to that?
It was good. It was good times. Like, it came at a good time as well, because I started to get frustrated at my first job, to be honest. We're having like an honest conversation.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
And
cool.
But you're saying the first job, what are you referring to?
At the dry school, I started to just get a little bit frustrated.
Yeah.
And the reason why I got frustrated is because I was just around great, great work and great quality of work, but I didn't have a big enough role in any of the plays.
Right.
So I just started feeling some type of way, like, this is a waste of my time, to be honest with you. I just wanted more. Like, I was really hungry just to get involved in something. And Attack the Block happened towards the end of the run at the theater.
This is a character who doesn't have a lot of dialogue, which means he has to communicate his thoughts and feelings a lot through his eyes. I understand that you sort of consulted some other work to arrive at how to do that. Is that right? Was there something with I'd read about The Wire and some other shows that...
Yeah, I had watched, I've been a big fan of those shows, but that wasn't necessarily to convey emotion. I think that comes through like training and the general things you do to become an actor. But I think The Wire was just inspirational for me because there were a lot of British actors in there who were playing Americans, and I found that quite cool and skillful.
What was the most daunting part about Moses, though?
None of it. It was
you felt
I'll
at
be
home.
Honest. It was fun. It was we were young and still young now, but it was a different kind of young. We were teenagers, and we were just having fun. Like, come to set, have fun, film the scenes. Kind of understood what it was about. It was like aliens in the hood, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that much of a jump. We all lived in the hood, you know, at the time. So it was just kind of like, whatever. Then we'd just be like an extreme part of ourselves. But I just catered Moses towards, you know, the sci-fi heroes that I quite liked. It's kind of like a silent tension.
Right. My understanding is when you guys were making that movie, you figured it's going to be a small little movie, seen in England maybe. That was sort of the extent of it. But it gets picked up by Screen Gems. It gets distribution in the U.S. And at that point, when it was clear that it was going to get a much bigger audience than you guys had originally anticipated, what was your thought process? It's time to get to LA or what?
I was already in LA.
Yeah?
I was in LA, like, just to trying to establish my own thing, and then Screen Gems bought the rights to Attack the Block, well, the right to distribute.
Right.
And then I was staying in a motel off of Hollywood Boulevard, and then they moved me at the hotel to the motel to the Ritz-Carlton.
That's great.
It was a big few steps.
Big change quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. As soon as Screen Gems got that, then my accommodation changed.
Yeah, I bet.
And then I was introduced to Per Diem.
Yes. And how about an agent? That's when.
That's when CAA. There was like a buzz about an agent, and I got with CAA, and then I started auditioning out here like professionally.
So what it seems like those next few years. I want to maybe mark it by saying before Imperial Dreams, which I'm going to ask you about, what was going on during those, I guess, 2-3 years? There were a couple of a pilot that must have been very exciting to you that didn't end up getting picked up. This
was likely. The brick was kind of like what I gained from Attack the Block.
Right.
You know, the HBO was doing a really cool series loosely based off of Mike Tyson's life, and Spike Lee was directing, and it was, you know, it was a great script. But it didn't work out.
Was that kind of a crushing thing at the time, or was it just on to the next thing?
For me, it was on to the next solely because I felt like I could have done better.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel like I was ready for that. I think everything happened really quickly, so I was okay with it. But at the same time, obviously, the money would have been good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And, well, so there was, after that, I guess, in that period, also the 24, Live Another Day miniseries for Fox and some supporting roles in movies. But also around that time, I guess, and correct me if this order of events is wrong, but this is what I had read. One of the people who caught up with and loved Attack the Block was Mrs. J.J. Abrams, who goes home and wakes up Mr. J.J. Abrams and says, you got to go check out this guy in this movie who is terrific. And it was because of that he was first aware of you?
Yeah, I heard that too. And it must have been true because when I first met him, he already knew my name, and I mean, he already knew about Attack the Block. And I met him because I was actually going for a general meeting at Bad Robot with Brian Burke.
Okay.
And he was coming out of the editing booth with Tom Cruise, just walking.
As that happens, you just bump into them, yes.
I mean, I was thinking, you know, some LA stuff, right?
Right.
So we're in Hollywood, that's kind of pretty standard.
And what did he say to you?
It was really nice. He said he really loved my work in Attack the Block, and he's going to find me something, you know, he's going to find me something to be in. I didn't take him seriously, to be honest with you, because that's kind of what everybody says.
Right,
when you go
for
a meeting, it's like, oh, no, we'll find you something.
Well, I have to say that even before I'd seen Attack the Block, because I guess I was late to that party, I think my first introduction to your work was Imperial Dreams, which was the Sundance Film Festival Audience Award winner in 2014. And one of the producers, I guess, of this very indie movie was Jonathan Schwartz, who does a lot of movies that go to Sundance, and had said, you know, come over to CAA and see this. This guy's amazing.
Mm.
So I did. And I wonder, because this was another one that, not an outspoken character, so you really had to find other ways to communicate what was going on. Very conflicted guy. We should say the character is Bambi, a 21-year-old who gets out of prison and goes home to try to resume life with his son. How did that one come about, and what did that one represent to you?
Well, at the time, I had way too much time on my hands. I had nothing to do. And I just needed work, but I needed good work. I felt like I needed an American version of Attack the Block in some sense. Mm. A movie that would create buzz at the festivals and that would get my name, you know, back into the conversation in rooms. So Imperial Dreams came about, and I decided to audition from London. And I came over here to L.A.,
Was this the first time you needed to nail that American accent?
No. I mean, I'd been auditioning for American stuff throughout, like, 24. I was American.
Oh, right.
Not particularly a great American in 24. I sounded Scottish in some scenes, I can't lie. Yeah, I mean, I was just trying to get my feet wet. And I was 21, 22 at the time. So I was just trying to grow and learn more. And I just thought this would be a great project to be a part of.
And as great as it was, and it really was, on top of coming, you know, fairly soon after Attack the Block, it sounded like you had, in an interview afterwards, you had a little frustration. You said, quote, My biggest challenge is to not do urban movies for the rest of my life. Those alpha hoodies. I like diversity. I am just 21, but I'm done with all the urban stuff. You get sent these urban movies, and it's the same old thing, close quote.
I sound like a G. At 21, I'm saying that. That's what I'm talking about.
you were done with that?
Honestly, man. Yeah. But it's quotes like that that make me happy, because no one can say to me, John, you've changed, man. Nah, I've always been like this.
So what was it? It was just that you were afraid of being somehow typecast?
Yeah, I just think at the time I was discovering just Hollywood for the first time. I was kind of learning on my feet as to how things worked.
Yeah.
And I was starting to understand that the industry is not going to do the specific work to make your career somewhat diverse or versatile. It's something that you have to really fight hard for.
Yeah.
And so when I started to realize that, I just started to get really frustrated. It's like, okay, cool. So they're going to just keep on bringing the kind of the same old thing. And you need people, you know, who support and believe in you to be able to believe that you can do something better and different,
right,
that can kind of just add some versatility to your craft and open doors for other opportunities.
Yeah. Well, it was, I guess, around that time, it sounds like, even before you were contacted about Star Wars, you had friends that were being contacted about auditioning. Is that true?
I put friends on tape for Star Wars.
So, like people we all know of?
I put friends on tape for Star Wars, and I was playing Rey. That's messed up. I was there. No, seriously, I was there, like, fixing up the camera for him, and, you know, I'd be like, oh, what is this for? And he'd be like, yeah, you know, don't tell anyone, it's for Star Wars. And, you know, I can't lie, I was feeling some type of way, like, you know, this is the first time I've heard they're seeing black people for Star Wars. Do you know what I mean? So I was a bit like,
yeah,
where's the phone call? So,
especially because I assume you knew it by that point that it was JJ doing it, right?
Well, I knew that, but I didn't. As I said, when I met him and he said, oh, we're going to find you something, I didn't necessarily hold on to that, because I had come to LA and experienced various people who had, you know, promised that, you know, they'd, you know, consider me for this, that and that, and it didn't work out. So, I just understood that, you know, sometimes things happen and they can't follow through. So
how did you find out now that there was actually interest in you auditioning as well?
I was on the train in London. I was coming back. I had a dodgy financial advisor at the time. I went to, that's all I could afford.
Right.
And I used to go see him in Tottenham, and I was on the train back to Southeast, and my agent called me and told me that they want to see you for Star Wars.
And how did you take that?
I was just like, it's go time, man, finally. Like, yeah. This was starting to get embarrassing.
Right.
You know, next person is going to tell me if they audition for me is my dad. And I'm like, wait, what?
All right, so now that began what sounds like almost kind of torturous period of something like 7 months where there was no real clarity about where this was going, and just repeatedly having to do different things that you could call auditions, I guess. But I mean, what were they asking of you in that time period?
I mean, I guess the tricky thing about those auditions is that I didn't know who the character was. So
they
they couldn't share much. So I couldn't read the full script or anything. So I could only kind of guess what they wanted. But I knew that this was the male lead. So I assumed that he was, you know, heroic and strong and you know, just upfront badass. And that wasn't the case. And so my second audition was with JJ, and normally that hasn't happened with me specifically. Normally you meet the director, for me anyway, mm-hmm, the third audition, you know, later down the line. Mm-hmm. And my second audition was with JJ, and so he was there to help
steer it a little bit.
Yeah, but it was funny, because sometimes I'd go to Pinewood to have a meeting with him, and he'd have almonds in his hand, and he was just like, okay, trying to explain what the story is without giving it away.
Right.
And so it was just a comedy show. I was just like, what's this guy talking about, man? I still don't understand.
And would you get specific feedback about what you were doing that, you know, because this, it sounds like you were there a lot of times. Each time you would go, would they just try to, aside from sharing a little bit of an overview of the story, would they say, you know what, we need you to do this a little differently or this a little differently?
Yeah, I needed to train more, like lose some weight. There was a lighter edge that they liked to the character, a more comedic flow. And I didn't know, just nobody said comedy. Maybe that was a secret as well. I don't know, but it just took some time. But I appreciate the process, because it really did feel like a workshop, and it never did feel like, you know, like they weren't on my side. Like they wanted me to obviously come in and do the job, but it was hard to get there. I can't lie. I just didn't understand.
Yeah.
I'd never been in an audition in which what you're auditioning for is a secret. So as an actor, it's like, how do I go to where you need me to go? But
so is that what kind of, it sounds like something motivated you to go check out on YouTube, as anyone can, the original auditions of Harrison Ford and Mark Hamill?
Yeah, I just wanted to know what vibe they were going for, because I know the last set of trilogies were the prequels, and that had a completely different tone.
Yeah.
So I didn't know that whether they, with each trilogy, were trying to find a different thing. So then I realised that, you know what, I'm always off with my searching. I'm trying to search for a certain tone and I'm not getting it. So let me just go back to the originals and fix my tone to what they already know.
And it was helpful.
And it was very helpful.
So take me through the day that you found out that you actually got this.
I had a premiere for Half of the Yellow Sun the night before. And I went to Catford to go and stay with some friends. And in the morning when I woke up, I got an email from JJ saying, "Where are you?" with question mark. And I'm like, "Is this guy trying to rob me or something?" Right. I don't, what's going on? And I said, "I'm in Southeast." And then I got a call from my agent saying, "You need to get up now. JJ wants to meet you." And then JJ emailed me saying, "I want to meet you. Come to Mayfair." Mm-hmm. Nina Gold, the casting director, had been calling my agent because they were trying to get a hold of me. I didn't know what was going on.
Did you suspect?
I mean, I knew that it was decision-making time, because after my last audition, I knew that was the last one.
Right.
But also, I was just like, JJ's a nice guy. If he was going to tell me I didn't get the part, he'd probably, you know, invite me for some food, at least, you know, send him off to depression with a full stomach. Do you know what I mean? I feel like JJ would have done that.
Right.
So I just got ready real quick, and I went down to Mayfair to find out what he wanted to say.
I mean, I'd love to know how that conversation went, but it sounds also like part of it, once he put it out there, what it was about, was also kind of cautionary. Like, before you give me your answer, you got to think about some things.
Yeah, which was very nice, actually. Which is very nice. It just goes to show that he also was taking into consideration our personal lives, like our lives, like being as this is like a cultural phenomenon.
So you sit down, he says, "Hi, John, now what?"
Yeah, he was just like, he thanked me first. The first thing he thanked me for was for coming back. And if I found that confusing, man, he was like, "No, thank you for coming back." So like, I'm just going to be like,
blow up Star Wars, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even getting there, though, that day for you, it sounds like, was a sacrifice.
Yeah, I emptied up my account.
Just to get to the meeting where he's going to tell you.
£75, crooks.
Jesus.
It was a black cab at the time.
Right.
That's why we don't use you. Uber. It was £75.
But I'm sorry to interrupt, because you were saying, you get there after bankrupting yourself. You sit down.
Yeah, bankrupting like minus £76.10.
There's a fee also when you go under, right?
Yeah. So that's all the way from Catford over to Mayfair. And I get there and JJ's sitting in an area that was just completely empty.
Right.
Like the Godfather. Like, he fully had the other side of the restaurant packed out. And he was just there on the other side by himself, and everywhere was empty and it was closed off. And I went to sit down, and he was on his phone, and he didn't even look up at me when he was saying hi. He was just on his phone, like, obviously sending an important email.
Right.
That's when he asked me the important questions and thanked me for being part of the process.
Well, but first, he first has to say you got it, right?
Yeah, I mean, after he asked me about, you know, just basically, like, brief questions about, you know, whether or not I'd be prepared for something like this, then he went on to say, you know,
"I got it.
You're the new star of Star Wars."
Now, when he was saying to you, you'd said in another interview that basically he said the job isn't just to be an actor in a movie. When you're doing something like Star Wars, it's a significant lifelong commitment to this thing. It could be an enormous burden. It did not give you any pause?
I didn't care about that, man. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah?
I didn't hear any of that. I thought about that later. Like, oh yeah, he had a point.
It was just, you know, I can get home now, right?
Because I auditioned for a whole bunch of stuff that I thought I was going to get.
Yeah.
I auditioned for Kingsman.
Okay.
I auditioned for Maleficent. I auditioned for, like, I auditioned for so many stuff, like, so much stuff that I was, The Maze Runner, you know, I thought I was going to book those jobs. So. Right.
But this would be a different magnitude in the sense that people's generations of families are enamored.
I know. So in my mind, I was thinking, after all those big movies that you flopped on,
right.
imagine the story if you go and get Star Wars. I'm like, that's a good
you
book.
You just wanted a good bar a, story or something.
That's a real good, that's right. a real good narrative yeah, right, right there. So I just went towards it. I was just like, this is going to be the final one. I'm like, if I didn't get Star Wars, I probably would have taken some time off because I was like so close to the opportunity within a short amount of time.
Yeah.
So that would have been a bit stressful.
And after it had sort of sunk in a little bit more when maybe, I mean, had you been a guy that was into Star Wars as a kid or any of that stuff?
Yeah, I love Star Wars. I love sci-fi as a whole. And,
but
yeah.
So then knowing, being familiar with it, you know that while it's obviously helped to catapult a lot of careers, Harrison Ford probably first and foremost among them, it also, there are some people who we don't really ever see again after Star Wars, and yeah. they're very, it's out there. I mean, it's not like a secret, partly because I guess you can get so typecast, or not typecast, but just associated with exactly. a character.
Yeah, because it's a massive... There's a massive brand, and, yeah. and so with other projects, it can be hard for other people to like differentiate the two.
So none of that, though, was. It sounds like you weren't ever too worried about any of these side things.
No, I wasn't. And the main reason was because I had worked before, and so maybe the projects I'd done before just meant something.
Yeah.
In comparison, but at the same time, I just trusted that my skills would pull me through. I'd be able to do other things convincingly, you know, to convince those that. Probably saw it as a Star Wars thing with every movie.
Right. Yeah. Did JJ ever articulate to you why he chose you over these others?
I don't know. Till this day, I don't really know. As long as I got the part, to be honest.
Yeah, who cares?
That check came right. through, goddamn.
So I guess chronologically, the next thing that came up here was that, you know, I guess Star Wars fans feel particularly passionately about they feel possessive of the whole franchise, you know,
yeah.
and throughout the history of Star Wars, there had been drops of diversity. We'd seen, of course, you know, Billy Dee Williams and Samuel L. Jackson, and then I guess behind the mask, James Earl Jones.
Mm.
But as news got out that this new Star Wars was going to center around a young white woman, a young black man, young black British man, and a young Guatemalan American.
Yeah.
Some of these guys turned out not to be very happy about that, and in fact were quite rude about it. And I just wonder, you know, you had been a increasingly, I guess, well-known person, but probably more on a local and national
level. Yeah.
Now you're in front of the whole world, and you're having to deal with the, particularly, I guess, after the trailer, the crap of some of these bigots. How did you personally handle that?
I mean, at first I was quite pissed because, you know, I just didn't understand what the issue was. To be honest with you, I had perspective on it because it just taught me something about how bad things work and how much bad things can be louder than good things. And to be honest with you, that whole boycott Star Wars thing, it didn't really have a lot of numbers. It was a lot of good people who were talking about it that gave it the media attention. It wasn't a big enough movement to do anything to box office to the movie's success. So as much as it did disturb me, to be honest with you, it also exposed me to how much, you know, good people are out there who were just like, no, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
And it was most people. So for me, that made it easy for me to respond in a way that was just, most of my comments were basically thank yous to the fans, and then, you know, to
and
the rest
of
them.
You had a pretty cool Instagram FU to the others.
So yeah, man, it was just like, to be honest, it was that kind of a moment, but it was also like get used to it because I knew about other roles that other people were booking. It wasn't just about me. People were in other franchises and who weren't necessarily white, and that for me was, it's just a time and something they would have to live through. So I was just trying to warn them, man.
Yeah,
I care about those guys, man. Just trying to warn you.
Well, just a couple other quick Star Wars things and then on from that. But I just have to ask you, when along the line did you meet the original three, Harrison, Mark, and Carrie? And did they, as probably, you know, really the small club of people who could understand what you were about to experience to some degree, although that was they went through it before the internet, did they have any kind of words of wisdom that were useful as you went out into the desert and wherever else you guys made this and went to work?
I feel like the advice any of them gave was based on that particular day. You know,
you mean the
drink water? Yeah. It wasn't like big, long time kind of, you know, long term kind of advice.
Right. Nothing Yoda-esque.
No, it wasn't like that on set, because I mean, I guess it is different times, but it was always good. I would particularly learn from the stories that each of them would tell. You know, I'd learn from that more than anything. I just think that you get onto set, and although, like, you know, myself and Daisy, you know, we were the youngest and kind of like the kids on the set, there's still work to be done, and so you just keep it going.
And the scale of everything just being so huge, that was and unlike, I think, anything you or probably anyone had experienced up to that point. Mm. You just still approached your job of acting in exactly the same way, or
yeah, because the bigger the better. If you have like visual effects and things like, you know, around you that help support a scene and it's, you know, high quality, it's excitement for me anyway. Like, yeah. It doesn't intimidate me. It makes me just more excited to work, because you're just given an opportunity to now, you know, be as close as you're ever going to get to being a space hero.
Yeah.
And it's the biggest of all time. And that for me, it's just motivation to just want to have fun, really.
So you get through that whole period, you get to the world premiere, which I was able to go there through my work. It was exciting and hugely exciting and special for me and to bring my brother. So I can't even imagine what it was like for you. And I know you brought some special guests as well. And I just wonder what that whole evening was like, because I would imagine that's when it kind of sunk in what you had fully been. I don't know if you'd seen the movie before, but I would guess that just the whole, you know, the whole thing probably took on a new feeling after that.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely did. Just the reality that Star Wars was going to be released to the world, and that people all over the world would see it. Many people would have different opinions. You know, your face is now in the public eye. And at the time, everybody's giving advice. You know, things are going to change, fame. And everyone's and now everybody's changing as well. Everybody's getting all fearful about what's about to happen. And I was kind of like, you know, okay, cool. I'll just ride the wave just to see how it goes for me.
Right.
And it was great. It was a time I got to invite, especially the premiere in LA. Mm-hmm. Everybody that basically helped me while I was staying out here, who'd given me a place to stay when I needed it, who you know, drove me down to my auditions. They got to come and
some friends from home.
Yeah, man. Home. The premiere in London, I had like everybody from home.
Yeah. How did things change? I mean, obviously they had to have in a major way, but like, what could you no longer do that you had done before? What do you miss doing? I mean, what was just the actual impact on your life of the whole world now seeing this movie in almost record numbers?
I mean, it was great having, you know, a whole bunch, having the film do well. I don't know, but I've always felt detached to that, because it's we all share the burden. Everybody worked hard. So I didn't necessarily feel like some kind of distinct pressure in any way. I think at the time as well, we weren't in one country long enough to feel the heat, because we were moving around doing publicity. I wasn't as exposed.
But at the end of that whole press tour and everything, you just go home and go on.
I just got on with my life. To be honest with you, you know, you're getting recognized here and there, but it's not some Harry Styles stuff. It was pretty mild. Yeah. Until today, it is actually manageable. Like, I don't know how long that's gonna last.
Right.
But it's just one film. It's one movie. And it was calm. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was gonna be.
Already at that point, I mean, how early, maybe even during the making the movie, when did you start thinking about how do I follow Star Wars with something outside of Star Wars? Because obviously the Star Wars commitment's gonna be ongoing, but what's going to be the first thing I do after Star Wars? Was it a strategic decision?
Well, I knew I wanted to work between the films, because I understood that most of the population would probably be introduced to me through Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And not all of them would go back to see my early work. So there was obviously something to prove in terms of versatility and the other stuff that I could do. And then that's why I joined the Circle. I just wanted to be in collaboration with a good cast.
You should say Tom Hanks. And
you know, Tom Hanks is pretty self-explanatory.
Yes.
Even though I didn't have any scenes with him, it was just nice to be a part of something like that. And I'd done that as a way to kind of just break it up a bit.
Yeah.
And then every time I'd do something, I'd realize that I just needed something bigger. Yeah. I need something significant to do between these movies that just, you know, makes a separation.
When you say significant, you mean significant in what way?
Significant in story, significant in director, in the other cast members that I'm going to be put with. Just something that when someone sees the project on paper, they go, this could be really good.
Right.
Just to collaborate with the best, really.
Well, that leads nicely into Detroit, of course, where we'll just tell people who are going to be having the opportunity to catch up with this over the coming weeks as it rolls out. You play Melvin Dismukes, security guard who winds up in the Algiers Motel during a horrific incident that takes place there in 1967 in Detroit. You've said already of this movie, quote, "This was huge to me. To me, this is the biggest thing I've ever done so far. It's the biggest movie of my career so far." And you added, quote, "This movie is far beyond anything I've ever done," close quote. So how do you, I guess to begin with, how did you wind up working here with the first female director ever to win the Best Director Oscar, Kathryn Bigelow? Mm-hmm. And then also, what is it about the project that even after something as huge as Star Wars would lead you to say what I just quoted?
I got a call from my agent to audition for this in New York. I just came out of nowhere. And it was very quick because of the times between the Star Wars films. It was like, this is probably something you want to get involved with. It's an ensemble piece, so you won't be in for the whole run. So it's enough of a commitment where you can also go and jump back into Star Wars. But you will be a part of something, you know, that comes from the best kind of creative quality. And it's Kathryn Bigelow. At the time, it was called an untitled Kathryn Bigelow Project.
Right.
So I flew out to New York and I auditioned in front of her, and then I'd done some improv. And then after that, I got the full script and got the part. And I was back to London for prep.
I bet post Star Wars, you're probably getting a lot of people that are offering you things without having to audition. So what made this worth going through an audition was that it was Kathryn Bigelow?
Yeah, it was Kathryn Bigelow. I needed to know for myself that I could do it. It's not easy doing roles that sometimes are based on true events without feeling like you want to be as integral as you can be to the story and the truth of it. So it was that in itself that attracted me to it and attracted me to auditioning.
Yeah.
I just wanted to go through the process so that if I did book the role, I knew I deserved it,
right,
in a sense. Not just because everyone's giving it to me because I'm in the Star Wars.
Right. Now, unfortunately, at least prior to the release of your film, I would say that most Americans today, and particularly young Americans, don't know what happened in Detroit in 1967. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine, therefore, that it's not sort of central to what Brits also learn about or know about. So when did you first become aware of this horrific kind of incident?
I knew about the uprising in Detroit from a while back. I stayed with a family in Inglewood and we watched a documentary called Hidden Colors. And within that was several different stories about Black history that was quite, you know, distant from what we know. And when they talk about Black history, the main story is obviously Martin Luther King,
right,
and Malcolm X. And for us in the UK, especially, is the move-in from a lot of Caribbeans who came in and basically helped build the infrastructure of London. And so for me, that those stories were just far detached from what I knew about. And so I knew about the uprising in Detroit. You know, I knew about, you know, the destruction of Black Wall Street. I knew about those distinct stories, but I didn't know about what happened at the Algiers Motel, right, specifically. I had no idea. So yeah, that I was surprised when I first read it.
Yeah. We should emphasize that Melvin Dismukes is a real man who is still with us. And so I wonder, beyond the script, you know, were you able to speak with him and learn more about his perspective before the camera started rolling?
Yeah, once I got the part, we jumped on a conference call first, and we had a very long, lengthy discussion with myself and Kathryn and Melvin. At first, it was just about getting to know him, you know, just getting to know, you know, what he's like and just how life is for him at the moment. You know, reminiscent conversation about his childhood and about stuff that he used to do. And then we got into the nitty-grits of the actual events and his opinions of that. It was a very informative conversation.
I was amazed to learn in a piece about you and Will Poulter that was just in the LA Times that he takes flack from a lot of people for the way he handled himself, which I just can't believe, because it seems to me that he...
Yeah, I mean, he was labeled an Uncle Tom because people expected him to be a hero to do something more to ensure the safety of those boys, even though the safety of those men as civilians is really in the hands of those officers,
right?
Because that's their job.
Right.
It's not his job.
No,
he didn't have to be there. He didn't prepare for that. And most people that are talking about that are probably tweeting it from a nice air-conditioned room and are not in the circumstance he was in.
Yeah, what would they have him do?
Everybody thinks they're Spider-Man until they get into the damn suit. Everybody has a suggestion they would make as to how someone should have handled the situation. Come on, man.
That's
like so many crazy officers with guns, you know, around him. He could have been flanked. Anything could have happened.
Right.
I wouldn't have left the grocery store.
Well, just the fact that he stayed there is probably something that kept the situation from being even worse.
And he spoke about that. He spoke that and you'll see in the movie that especially Cross, Will Poulter's character, he always references Des Mewkes when he's about to do something. There's always a look because he's super aware that he is there. And so Melvin spoke about that and said that it felt like his presence, you know, brought some form of time or balance to the situation. And he was really brainstorming as to what to do. And he knows that, you know, maybe I could have done this, maybe I could have done that. But in the moment, I didn't wake up preparing for this. I'm the only guy. I'm the only guy there.
It's crazy.
So I don't know. Like, I think it's wrong that he was treated in that way.
I read that maybe the most effective way of you feeling what it was like to be him or the people who have really followed in terms of being the victims of police brutality was when the schedule shifted one day. What happened there, and why did that really tap in, you know, sort of connect with you in a way you couldn't have anticipated?
I mean, and that also ties into a question I didn't get to answer before about Detroit being the biggest movie in my career so far.
Yeah.
I remember someone was telling me yesterday that they read up on that, and they go, are you crazy? You've been in Star Wars. How could Detroit be the biggest movie of your career? Because it depends what you value as quality.
Right.
And for me, quality is longevity, and longevity in acting is an access to skills and an appeal that could see you getting work for years, hopefully. And so for me, I just felt like I discovered that side of myself while doing Detroit.
Right.
So that in itself will be the biggest movie of my career,
right?
Because whatever you see me do after Detroit would have been inspired by, you know, the artistic freedom I felt I had, how deep I was able to go emotionally into a character, which gives me freedom for other things. And that day was the day that I discovered that, because we were supposed to shoot a completely different scene and we had a technical difficulty. And so sound were picking up an AC that couldn't be turned off at that side of the building.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go and use that interrogation room. And that was the only scene that we could film.
And this is the scene, just to contextualize, and, you know, people will hopefully listen to this after they've seen the movie. They kind of turn the tables on you and make it as if you're potentially a perpetrator of what happened there. Mm-hmm. And so now all of a sudden you're on the defensive.
Yeah, Melvin is now facing a first-degree murder charge. And that in itself was a big shock to him and something that I had to film. And so I hadn't filmed because before, the way it was set up, that I would film these scenes that would kind of like give me much more, just warm me up for that scene, you know? And we didn't get to do that because of the time. So I had to find some way of going there. And any way I could go there is to try and, through the character anyway, all times through the character, is to relate to things that are happening now that has made me feel personally some type of way. Hence why I referenced Sandra Bland and Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown and those situations that we've seen coming up.
Where you see kind of a thread connecting what happened.
Yeah, there's a connection. And for me, the shock of us still having that conversation just as a mere reaction on screen could also mirror the shock of you just now being told that you're about to go down in a horrible way and your life is going to change in a negative way, even mm-hmm. though you haven't done anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I was able to just kind of, you know, do it, a little bit of a cheat.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah, turn it into a positive.
And then just turn it into the motivation for the scene, being as I didn't prep for it that day.
For an audience member who had nothing to do with the making of the movie, it feels, I think, like a pressure cooker. You just feel it building and building and building and you just wait. So I wonder, though, for you guys on the set, it just seems hard to imagine that this is one where you can just hear cut and, you know, have a fun time. What was the vibe on the set?
The vibe was good. There was obviously a level of intensity we had to keep. I was quite isolated a lot of the time, just giving the character and what I wanted to convey while the cameras were rolling, just a fresh insight of knowing that Melvin is basically the silent observer of all of these things. So I just wanted to keep my reactions fresh, and I just think the vibe was cool, and it wasn't always serious.
Yeah.
Especially when Anthony Mackie was on set talking about those damn cocoa beans on the island that he... So it was good vibes, and everybody, in order to get that deep in terms of the scenes, and even in terms of the abuse and the name calling and the, you know, all of that, in order to get there, we had to have a level of unity between us, and we did, and everyone was cool, asking if everyone was all right. You know, half of those boys, as soon as they were done, you know, on those walls, they'd go to the food stop and ham down paninis. Jacob Lattimore. I'm going to call him out, Jacob Lattimore.
Yeah, that's there we go.
Jacob, that's all Jacob was doing.
It's too funny.
So we had really fun moments.
Right. Yeah. So as the film's been rolling out, for people that are, I guess, paid to have an opinion, whether it's a critic or pundit or whatever, there's been wonderful feedback. I think the movie's still at like 100% or something on Rotten Tomatoes. But as always, there's people that find something to bitch about. And in this case, the two things I want to just ask you to, if you can offer your sort of take on, I would say I'm assuming rebuttal, is that some people, black and white, are raising the question of whether it is appropriate for Kathryn Bigelow, a white person, to tell the story of what was an incident that primarily affected black people.
Yeah.
What's the way you see that?
For me, I just kind of connect that, and I understand that thought, and the thought is not something to be dismissed. But for me, when I had that thought, it was more on the level of, she has obviously decided to use her platform, her success so far, to shed a light on this particular story. And knowing that the work she's done, this is going to be done in a very tasteful way. We're going to get good characters, good story. We're going to get a real perspective on the truth. And that's something that I was just like, it's interesting that she herself is putting herself in that position. Because one thing we should take out of that question is that she's not trying to take the mick out of black people.
Right.
And if you are going to take the mick out of black people, I don't think you'd put your face out there in interviews and do a whole big movie about it.
No.
That'd be even if you are racist, I'm thinking it's the wrong way to handle it.
Right,
you know,
right,
so that you're moving a bit exposed there.
Right.
But she approached with a lot of integrity and respect. And for me, as she said, she doesn't think she is the right person, you know, to do it. She said that many times, but she just felt compelled to do her thing. And for me, the only thing that I could really rely on, I can't rely on her experience, I can't rely on her particular perspective, because she is who she is, but what I can rely on is her openness to learn, seeing the great research team she has around her, the fact that she has embraced the real people, the real survivors of this situation, the fact that they were, you know, there on set. For me, that in itself is, it grows trust, and this is someone who put in time and work and research, and to be honest with you, you know, despite her detachment to this narrative, we all had to do a level of research,
yeah,
you know, some of which was similar to what she had to do,
mm-hmm,
because we didn't know about this. We weren't there. And despite the fact that, yes, I am black, Algie's black, Jacob's black, we all haven't had these significant, you know, direct experiences that our characters go through. So we all, in a sense, have to research and have to fill in the blanks to a detachment that we have.
Well, that anticipates the part B, which is that nothing. It's something that I know you've heard and responded to, I guess, before, but it comes up here where, you know, this whole debate over within the black community of actors, there are some people who imply that basically American black people should be portrayed by American black actors. And even beyond that, that Will Poulter, you know, as a Brit playing an American, they were. What do we say to this, though? I mean, it seems to me you can get pretty ridiculous with this, where these are not documentaries.
I mean, it's just a sensitive time, so you have to understand first. I believe that before you come up with a response, just understand what the concern is.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand in a time in which, you know, representation is a hard thing to get, and diversity is a hard thing to get. People feel some type of way. They feel like, okay, the one role that we do get, can it just be one of us in it? And I understand that.
but it can't be that way. Yeah. It can't be that way.
Not fair.
I'm sorry. I got to work. I got to work. God damn it. Got to work. God damn. You know, it's, and I understand it, but, and the reason why I laugh is because also it's a lack of knowledge. It's a lack of knowledge. A lot of people have that opinion based on the fact that they don't know about the black experience outside of America. So all of these lines that they think are blurred to us because they think it's all tea and crumpets in the UK, they don't understand that right. Race relations, the black experience, the vibe of blacks, we are not detached from that just because we're not in the States. And even furthermore, a lot of us in the UK are directly from Africa.
Right.
Like our mum and dad still right. have names like, you know, Mbutu and Oluwatunde. So like we have a distinct connection to that.
Right.
And so it doesn't take much for us to go there. And also there's creative freedom, man. That's what actors do.
Right. Right.
And I don't know what the system is like in terms of how they teach in the drama schools in the United States. But in the UK, you are taught to harness your skills so that you can reflect it onto characters that are not you.
Right.
And a guy tweeted me the other day, it was hilarious. He said, nice American accent, John, but next time, take the American SAT before you play an American. And I asked him, okay, cool, that's fine, but what test do I take for Star Wars? I want to know which one.
Right, oh my God, they're such idiots.
But I don't get frustrated by that because it's a lack of knowledge.
Yeah.
And then also it's just understandable because it is a sensitive time in which Yeah.
With the remaining few minutes here, I just have some big picture, not that these weren't big picture questions, these most recent ones, but I guess, first of all, who do you hope will see Detroit and what do you hope they will take away from it?
I think, and this is obviously a simple answer, but that's how I feel. I just think it's for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I say everyone is because we are now at a time where we really do need to work on this whole how to coexist thing. Like, it's really getting to the time where we need to figure this whole thing out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that does require a level of unity. And I think there is power in unity. So I just feel like everybody needs to see it because it's uncomfortable to each person, each race, for obviously different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if the right intention is there, it can lead to good, healthy dialogue. So I just hope everybody sees it. Maybe not the kids. Give them a little time.
You've said, quote, all the films I've done have had a secret commentary on stereotypical mentalities. It's about getting people to drop prejudiced state of mind and realize, quote, oh shit, we're just watching normal people, close quote, which is sort of what I think you've just said. But do you think it's purely coincidental that those are the projects that you've done, or are you subconsciously drawn to that kind of material?
I mean, I say we because myself and the team that support me are very fixated on making everything a distinct decision. And now I'm at a point where I can really do that. So that's something that we do. And I like to be in things I like to watch, and some of the things I like to watch have great deep messages. And that's what I'll do from time to time.
Later this year, we'll obviously get to see you again as Finn, and in The Last Jedi, which is Rian Johnson's installment. You've obviously got a lot of secrets you've got to keep about that, but is there anything you can say about how it might differ from The Force Awakens?
The Force Awakens was a great foundation, and now we're about to build the big house.
And you have said much darker. And that your part's more physical?
Yeah, very physical. Very Finn is much more active and involved in the fight, which is something that I really wanted. So,
right. Since The Force Awakens, we obviously tragically lost Carrie Fisher, who I believe you worked very closely with, particularly on The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
How did you learn of her passing, and how do you think audiences are going to feel about the handling of her exit from the franchise?
I learned about her passing while I was on holiday in Nigeria on my Christmas break. So that was it was weird. It was a bit of a shock.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the send off is really cool, because even before she passed away, I'd see certain scenes and be like, no, this is really cool for both Carrie and Mark,
mm-hmm.
who are the last two original leads.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, especially for me, like I felt like they deserve more and more, you know. They've been doing this for a while and have been the beating heart of something special. And I just feel like 8 just pays homage to them in general before her passing.
But unfortunately, now she's passed, it does have a deeper meaning. Mm-hmm. And I think it still does facilitate that mm-hmm. as well, which for me is perfect. And I think the fans are going to appreciate that.
Sure. And then the last two, just I guess in 2018, we're going to see you as the lead in Pacific Rim Uprising, which happens to be the first project to come about through Upper Room Entertainment Limited, mm-hmm. which is the production company that you formed in 2016. Obviously, people would love to hear anything about the film, but I'm mm-hmm. more interested even in what was it that motivated you to start your own production company?
Because, you know, all of this is a learning process for me, and whatever decision I make is in reaction to what I'm seeing. And I'm, even until now, I just see an industry that needs fresh, new, original stories, an industry that can sometimes ignore the gems in upcoming artists and those who are not fully established. And I just wanted to make a forum in which I could do what I want mm-hmm. and have my own creative process, the way Kathryn Bigelow has her creative process, the way J.J. Abrams has his creative process. And I just saw it fit that it had to work through a company.
Yeah.
And I just always wanted to be behind the scenes as well. And I've always had a love for the quiet negotiators, which are producers.
Yeah.
I've always had love for them, the guardian angels of a project. And I've always wanted to be one. And so that's why I gave birth to Upper Room.
Well, so finally, looking ahead to the long-term future, during which it sounds like you're going to do both acting and producing, if you had to choose one other person's career path to have yours resemble, who would it be?
I like what James Cameron has done with his career. And I say that because if you're given a big enough platform to have your own significant brand and stamp on whatever you do, it's innovative, it's forward thinking. I think that's a solid career, man. And he got his own island. I just have to mention that. I want one.
well, thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.